The Baker Street Journal is a leading Sherlockian publication written by the readers for the readers. It contains both academic articles and light, fun reading for any sort of Sherlock Holmes enthusiast. If you are a fan of The Great Detective and the other works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and you'd like to read new and exciting writings by Sherlockians, or even find information on how to get published in the journal, please visit their website, www.bakerstreetjournal.com.
Wessex Press, an imprint of Gasogene Books, is a premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. They are also our publishers. The One Fixed Point in a Changing Age, a new generation on Sherlock's Holmes, is a collection of essays written by online fans. It was edited by several of the Baker Street Babes and contains a foreword by Laurie R. King, the author of the Mary Russell series. If you'd like to know more about Wessex Press or our publication, please go to www.wessexpress.com.
Oh, they call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh, so when Scotland, they send you home, you feel like you're losing your mind. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you two to one?
So we are live at BSI Weekend, and we are so lucky because we get to interview Bert Cools in his hotel room.
Hip hip! Hooray!
Thank you.
So you probably know Bert Cools because he wrote the fantastic BBC radio adaptation starring Clive Merrison, which is the only full adaptation of the entire Sherlock Holmes canon, which is just amazing in itself.
It is at the moment, but very soon it won't be.
Really?
Because a very small independent American company are just on the verge of completing their own complete canon.
You're still going to have been the first.
Exactly.
Absolutely. First. But I'm going to have to change all the publicity from only to the first. But I should give them a plug. Imagination Theatre, run by Jim French. And every single script is written by one person, a friend of mine called Matthew Elliott.
Oh.
And they're very, very good.
Thank you so much for telling us. That's wonderful.
Yay! Fantastic. So the first thing before we ask you anything else is that you have to be inducted as an honorary Baker Street Babe.
Oh, splendid.
Granted your permission, of course.
Oh, yeah, you have my permission, but I mean, just exactly what does it entail? Right?
Well,
yeah.
it's a consensual joining.
So there's a series of questions to
right,
ask,
okay.
Which are very difficult questions.
Oh, dear.
Maybe not for the reasons you're possibly thinking, but maybe.
Well, let's see.
All right, the first one is, how did you get introduced to Sherlock Holmes?
Ah, that happened when I was very young, about 10 or 11, I think. And I can't remember now if it was from the books or from the BBC radio series that was running then with Carlton Hobbs and Norman Shelley.
Oh, yeah.
Wonderful, I mean, a little bit dated now, but a wonderful series. And I can vividly remember listening to those. And it takes me so back. I mean, just talking about it now, I can see our living room and we had this wonderful radiogram, big polished radiogram.
Oh, beautiful.
And I can't remember if it was that or if it was the books. If I listened to the radio and then went to the library and got the books, or if it was the other way around. I suspect it was the radio first.
Is that, like, your first memory, like, listening to it on the radio while you wanted to then write for radio?
Oh, no, that came a lot later. I think at that stage I didn't really know what I wanted to do. But
When you were 11?
I mean, I think, you know, radio, we didn't have a TV when I was growing up, but radio, it seemed so wonderfully remote. You know, I didn't think ordinary people like me could write for the radio or get on the radio or anything like that. I discovered years later.
Fabulous. All right, so who is your favourite character from the Sherlock Holmes canon?
Oh, I'm not going to answer.
You have to.
Okay, my favourite character is Sherman the Animal Stuffer.
Old Sherman!
Purely because I hope no one else has given you that answer.
I love Old Sherman with his... He's got the... there's a some sort of weasel, like a stoat, with a baby rabbit in its mouth, like in the front window.
Yeah. and he's
brilliant.
He speaks, and a lot of people don't pick this up, he speaks in a very old-fashioned way that Dickens would have recognised. Wipe, he's like, I've got a wiper in this bag. Down comes the wiper.
Oh, man, he's about to throw a snake on Watson's head, it's amazing.
But the real answer is that I don't have a favourite. I mean, if I'm writing, I can't afford to have favourites. And that's if I'm reading, I just, my favourite is whoever's happened to be doing something good at the time.
Aww, that's a good rule.
Perfectly valid answers.
So another really unfair question then is, what's your favourite story from the canon?
I don't really have a favourite. Again, if you know, I've done so much work with them, you can't have a favourite, it's fatal. But I have a very soft spot for moments in stories. I mean, I think one of the most wonderful moments in the entire canon is in a story that a lot of people don't like at all, The Yellow Face.
Oh, I love that story.
Yeah, well, Wolverine. Then, congratulations, but a lot of people don't. There's a wonderful bit at the end where I've forgotten the guy's name, but they accept the little girl into the family. And Watson has this beautiful statement about it, which I'm not going to attempt to reproduce because I'll get it wrong, and I don't want to get it wrong. But it's lovely. It's really lovely. It's beautiful writing. It's ahead of its time.
I think he says that he always is glad to think of this memory. Like,
That's exactly it. But I'm not going to paraphrase it because I'll get it wrong, and I don't want to get it wrong. It's so lovely.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. So this is slightly different than your favorite character, Sir Sherman. But if you could have tea or whiskey with any character.
It would be tea. With any character. Oh, my word. Oh, it's so unfair. I mean, I would love to meet Watson.
Yeah.
I think I would rather meet Watson than Holmes. Because I have a lot in common with Watson, with writers and all the rest of it, you know. So I suppose Watson, but it's not really a valid answer because I don't know. I really don't know.
It's a hard one, but I feel like Watson would have all the dirt and he'd be able to.
Well, that's true.
If he got
that's
to liquor
true.
It up a bit, he'd
that's
just
true.
Keep going. It's like, I need to vent to someone.
You could get the real stuff from Watson, couldn't you?
Oh, yes.
The stories behind the stories.
Not the right size versions.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But failing that, I suppose Mary. Mary would be interesting.
Oh,
she?
I don't think
answer.
Anyone's ever.
No, that's a lovely
brilliant.
Answer.
Because she also has all the dirt.
Oh, my
she
word.
She knows yes. what's going on
yeah.
behind closed doors.
There'd be a lot of, as Holmes would put it, color in life.
There'd certainly be a lot of color.
Wait, all right, and the last question.
All right.
And you are allowed to be as selfish as possible with your answer. But what is your favourite adaptation of the stories?
I hate picking out a single favourite. If you told me that every single Sherlock Holmes adaptation was going to be wiped out of existence.
No.
You know, films, stage, radio, TV. I would want to save Murder by Decree.
Oh.
Because it's got its faults, but I think it's the best Sherlock Holmes movie ever made. And I wouldn't want a world that didn't exist in.
It's so sincere.
And it's got the pea scene. Smash
That's
peas.
That's true. The smash peas.
It's got the best ending of any Sherlock Holmes film. Because, and it's got an ending that breaks all the rules of what you can do in a mainstream movie. Where you've got 10 minutes of nothing but Holmes giving a speech. And it is a brilliant speech, and it's a brilliant performance, and it's beautifully written.
I actually haven't seen it.
Christine!
Oh,
I know.
Go now!
The interview is over!
Skip it out!
You must see it. It's a wonderful film.
Well, we can watch it tomorrow night. Okay. If you want. Christina has been
it's got
rejected
all sorts of things
for Cool's Hotel.
It's got things wrong with it. The story gets a bit convoluted in places. James Mason is really too old to play Watson. And none of it matters. None of it matters at all. The living room of Baker Street is like a mansion. They've got a grand piano.
You shouldn't wear a deerstalker to the opera.
I know. Yeah. They spell the name of the composer wrong on the poster. They get Donizetti wrong. It's full of stuff like that. And none of it matters. Oh, and the solution to the mystery is a really old, hackneyed solution to the mystery.
Okay.
Completely discredited now. But none of it matters.
That's so good, though. I know about the pea scene, because I think you've shown it to me.
The smash pea scene? Yeah, no, I found it on
YouTube. You squashed my pea.
You squashed my pea. Yeah.
I didn't want it squashed. I wanted to pop it in my mouth.
And Holmes is just looking at him like, I completely understand and I'm sincerely sorry.
It was a sincere conversation about pea.
Well, with that, you are now an honorary Baker Shooter.
Well, thank you very much. I am greatly honored and feel very privileged.
Yay.
Congratulations.
Your bikini will be coming in the mail.
Well, I look forward to it. Perhaps if there's a costume party next year.
There you are.
Sherlock Holmes on the beach.
Yeah.
In January.
Oh, don't.
I wonder how that would go down. Not very well.
No. It would go over like a lead balloon.
On that note, so for those who sadly haven't heard the series or anything, can you explain sort of what you did? I mean, you created, you worked with the BBC, created a full Sherlock Holmes adaptation. Yep.
I know, I wasn't working at the BBC. I'd left the BBC by then. I was a freelance writer. And I pitched to the BBC a dramatisation of The Hound of the Baskervilles. Now, I wasn't well established as a writer, and I didn't for a moment think they would go for it. But I thought, you know, what the hell, I'll try. And to my amazement, they did go for it, and they commissioned me to write a new Hound of the Baskervilles, which I did. It was two episodes, each episode an hour long. And it starred Roger Rees, who I think is known over here.
The name's slightly familiar.
He was, it's going back away, but he was in Cheers. He played Kirstie Alley's English boyfriend.
Yes.
In Cheers. You've got him.
And nice reference.
And he had a huge success on Broadway in a version of Nicholas Nickleby.
Oh, okay.
He won a Tony and all the rest of it. But wonderful actor, wonderful actor. And Watson was a guy called Crawford Logan, who's a Scottish actor, very well known at home.
That's possibly the best name I've ever heard.
Crawford Logan. I'll tell him you said so. And we did it, and it was a success, if I'm allowed to say that. And we immediately put in, the producer and I, another pitch to do A Study in Scarlet and The Sign of the Four. And the BBC wavered about it for a long time, and eventually they came back and they said, yes, we'd love you to do it, but we want it to be recast. We do not want Roger Rees and Crawford Logan. And that was a huge blow.
Oh, my.
It really was. I mean, they were wonderful actors. They did it beautifully. And the producer said, well, you know, do you want me to make a big fuss about it?
Mm.
And I said, well, you're not going to win, are you? And he said, frankly, no, I'm not. I mean, he was quite a junior producer. And so we said, OK, we'll recast it. And lists were drawn up of who we should cast. And eventually we got to a wonderful actor called Clive Merrison.
Mm-hmm.
As Holmes, and an equally wonderful actor called Michael Williams as Watson. Michael Williams is possibly best known as the husband of Judi Dench.
Mm-hmm.
yes.
Clive... Great title to have.
It really is.
Mr. Judi Dench.
Husband of Dame Judi Dench.
Yeah. He makes no bones about it. I'm Mr. Dench, you see. Actually, but what he used to say is that Judy's a better actor than I am. But there are some things I can do a damn sight better than she does. So they had a really, really wonderful relationship. Every Friday, he sent her a red rose.
Aww.
No matter where either of them were in the world, he arranged for her to be given a red rose.
Adorable.
My heart is swelling.
I'm sorry, this doesn't work on radio or podcasting, but three of us just... basically melted into puddles. So if you can picture that.
So we did Study in Scarlet and The Sign of the Four, which is the version of the title that I prefer personally.
I always get confused about that. That's the UK version, yeah?
No.
It's both are valid. It started off being the originus, The
yes.
Sign of the Four.
Yes.
That's
and
then right.
It's somehow, along the line, it became The Sign of Four,
yeah.
Which is a ludicrous title. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
The show is about a group of people called The Four.
The Four.
Who leave their sign around.
Right.
How could it not be called The Sign of the Four?
I think syntactically you're on really solid ground here.
Yeah, but we got a really, really nasty memo from the head of radio drama saying, what do you think, after the show was made and went out, what do you think you're thinking of? It's called The Sign of Four. Do not do this again.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so we made those. And I put forward a pitch to do six of the short stories. I thought, you know, we'll grab six of the best short stories. We've got a good team. Clive and Michael work wonderfully together. They were old friends, which helps.
Oh, good. Always helps.
And I put this in, and nothing happened. And I heard nothing. And I was at a Christmas party at the BBC Broadcasting House, which is the headquarters in London. And the head of radio drama was there. I said, what's happened to my suggestion? He said, we're thinking about it. And the next thing I knew was I had a letter saying, please come in to talk about Sherlock Holmes with a new producer and the head of radio drama. So I went in. And I walked into the room and there were two other writers there. And I thought, oh, why have they brought in two other writers on my little six-episode series? This is not good. Mm. And then we were told that they wanted to do the complete canon.
Oh.
Something which had never been done before. And they were going to do it a book at a time, in order, in publication order.
Oh, the collections, one
yes,
by one.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So we were starting with, you know, Scandal Bohemia going through. And the head of Radio Drama had a list of the stories. And he got a pen and he went, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, down the list. And he had three pieces of paper with 1, 2, and 3 on, which he dropped into a waste paper basket. It should have been a deerstalker, but it was a waste paper basket. And we were invited to pick out a number. And whichever number we got, they were the stories that we would be doing, all three writers. And thank God I got number one. And I was so pleased. Not because only because they're good stories. I mean, Scandal Bohemia, all the rest, I forget what the others are. But I wanted to be there first. I wanted to set the tone for the others. Because the other two writers, perfectly good writers, but they didn't necessarily see it the same way I saw it. They didn't want to do it the same way I wanted to do it. And that did lead to a few complications along the line. There was they don't use script editors in radio. Radio is cheap.
Yes.
I mean, it's not. It's expensive compared to most things in radio. Radio drama is very expensive, but compared to TV, it's peanuts.
Yeah.
But they don't use script editors, so the producer had to do an awful lot of rejigging. I got an awful lot of unofficial phone calls saying, we're not supposed to do this and we can't pay you, but do you really think that would happen in that story? And I had to say, no, I don't. But hey, why not have this happen? And then the poor producer had to go back to the other writer, not telling him that it was me who'd made the suggestion. So, no, I think this might happen.
So you were essentially the writer who was hired, who was already a Sherlockian. Who really had the entire canon. You were familiar with everything, and you basically were the story bible and the character bible for everything.
That's pretty much right, yes. We had a tone meeting at the very beginning. We all sat down and bashed out all sorts of things, like some things are silly now, like they should smoke. Holmes should still take drugs, as long as Watson could still object to Holmes taking drugs.
Yeah.
It was decided, quite a brave decision, it was decided that if a story was weak, then it was legitimate to bolster it up.
That's
to make it work as a drama.
It's one of the best things about that series.
Yeah. I mean,
sometimes.
The brief was, we want you to be imaginatively faithful. And I think that was a really good phrase. I mean, we seized on that, imaginatively faithful.
It's wonderful.
And what we didn't want to do was the hoary old thing of opening with Watson saying, well, I see from my notebooks that it was on the 30th of January, 1851. I then have the client come and tell their story, and then you go off and do the investigation. We wanted to get completely away from that and look at the stories as brand new material for drama, which meant dramatising scenes that aren't in the story, that are only mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
All that sort of thing. We didn't want to see everything through Watson's eyes, because it's so restricting. I mean, it works, you can do it, but it's not dramatic. And a dramatisation should be dramatic.
It's one of the hardest things about adapting any of those stories for film or for, you know... I mean, I think they probably did it most faithfully in the Granada series with Jeremy Brett, but it's a real challenge if you're only seeing something from a first-person narrative perspective.
I mean, if you take a story like The Crooked Man, the three most important people in that story are not Holmes and Watson at all. They're Henry Wood, Colonel Barclay, and Mrs. Barclay.
Absolutely.
And Colonel Barclay and Mrs. Barclay don't appear in the story at all.
But everything happens with them.
So what I did with that one was
I
went back to the beginning. I had a scene with Colonel Barclay on the battlefield and the betrayal, and I came into the row between Mr. and Mrs. Barclay, and I came into the row between Colonel and Mrs. Barclay and went through there. And Holmes and Watson crops up about 15 minutes in. And we got a note from the assistant head of radio drama this time saying, Holmes and Watson take an awfully long time to arrive, don't they? And I sent back a note saying, yes, they do.
Yes.
Nailed it. That's so good, though, because it expands the universe, as it were, but while still remaining pretty much in the confines of the story.
Absolutely.
And if you think about a story like, say, for example, The Final Problem, Watson never meets Professor Moriarty.
No.
A single time. He sees him on a train. passing, and that's it. That's the extent of their interaction.
He never properly meets
Irene Adler. Exactly. No. Yeah.
Well, he doesn't in my story, in my versions of both of those. But at least we're able to, I mean, in the final problem, strictly speaking, Moriarty doesn't appear in the final problem until you glimpse him on the station.
It's the only way
we know about the meeting in Baker Street is because Holmes tells Watson about it.
Exactly.
Now, I mean, you could do it like that. You could have Holmes say, oh, my God, something really dramatic has just happened. Let me tell you about it. But again, it's deadly. Why do that? Why not dramatise the scene?
Mm.
I mean, we've seen from loads of different versions, TV versions, stage versions, how wonderful that scene is.
Yeah.
And it's one of the cases where Doyle's dialogue, you need to do almost nothing to it. You need to prune it a little bit here and there. But it's wonderful, actable dialogue.
Yes.
So why do anything with it? I mean, a lot of the time, I found myself rewriting the dialogue. And I had no qualms about that. I mean, the famous one in Silver Blaze, the inspector says to Holmes, Mr. Holmes, is there anything else to which you would wish to draw my attention?
Mm.
Now, you can't give that to an actor.
No.
You cannot. I mean, you know.
That is the sort of syntax up with which we shall no longer put.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't remember now what I did, but I think it was, is there anything else you want to draw to my attention? I mean, it's the same with contractions. A lot of people use very formal language for period drama.
Right.
And I don't believe that that's how people spoke.
Mm.
Because it's that way in the books, in the novels. There's a world of difference, both for the actor and for the audience, between I cannot understand why Lestrade does not arrest him, and I can't understand why Lestrade doesn't arrest him.
Hmm.
A world of difference.
Yeah. And they do use contractions in the canon lots, because I've studied
absolutely
this tons for writing,
yes,
pastiches, and there's a line in the canon where someone says, what's up then?
Yeah.
And it's in the canon. I mean, it's right there, you know.
I think it's much more relaxed than we think.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
People
over embellish it quite frequently.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of pastiches fall down on that.
Mm. I agree.
They do what they think is Victorian dialogue,
yeah, exactly,
and Victorian description. And Doyle doesn't write that way. Doyle is wonderly simple and direct. And
well,
they're
temporary.
Yeah.
He's writing how people actually lived and spoke.
Yeah.
And sometimes when people imitate it, their version of Victorian dialect is unreadable dialect.
I'm afraid that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, some people nail it. Some people get it absolutely dead right.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people, I'm afraid, don't. And that's understandable. It's difficult. It's not easy to get that right.
No, not at all. You have to have a real ear for it.
Yeah.
How did you find the process of, like, I guess it's always cool to see, like, something you've written actually then come to life, and like seeing your words spoken by the actor. So, like, what was that like for you, especially as it just kept growing and growing to the whole full?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And it's a two-way process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, once we had Clive and Michael, then I began to write for Clive and Michael,
mm-hmm,
as well as writing for Holmes and Watson. And I mean, my version of The Lion's Mane, which people have been very kind about, is a two-hander. And the way they speak to each other is the way I'd heard for 4 years or whatever, Clive and Michael chatting to each other in the green room when they were working, just swapping stories and insults and, you know. And that's exactly what I lifted and gave to Holmes and Watson.
So good, just drawing from, like, the natural, like, charisma and, like, companionship of the actors.
Yeah.
That's what makes a lot of, like, adaptation stuff of, like, powerful duos, like, makes it so good. Like, you can look at Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman, that they have such a good rapport with each other that translates onto screen.
Hmm.
It happens very often in casting. Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr. are very close. Jeremy Brett's best friend was Edward Hardwick to the end of his life.
Yeah.
And Nigel Bruce, after he passed away, Basil Rathbone didn't play Sherlock Holmes ever again after Nigel Bruce was gone. And it's very touching how much, like, how many powerful friendships are built out of it.
And when it doesn't work, it's very noticeable that it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
There are famous films, and we won't go into which ones, but and TV, where it simply doesn't work, it doesn't gel. The friendship is everything.
Yes.
The
yes.
friendship is what the stories are about. The cases are incidental.
Oh, that preach.
Yes.
Preach. Testify.
Like, I love them so much, but I didn't fall in love with the mystery aspect of it.
Oh, sure.
I fell in love with their friendship and
their
and they had adventures with each other and their bickering, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like these two obviously know, but when I love someone so much, I am awful to them as well. I always really appreciated that.
Oh, no, I don't want to downplay the mysteries. I mean, the mysteries,
a
great mysteries, and Doyle was proud of the mysteries.
Yes.
And one of the reasons Doyle stopped writing Holmes is that he found the plotting so incredibly difficult to do.
Absolutely. And some of them start getting a little repetitive.
They do. And
he's got Stockbroker's Clerk and Redheaded League and the Three Gyarados, and they're all pretty much the same case.
That is one of the reasons, why The Hound of the Baskervilles is so good.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't his plot.
Mm.
I mean, Bertrand Fletcher Robinson more or less gave him the plot. I mean, obviously, they worked on it together and all the rest of it. But he was jaded by that time about the necessity of coming up. I mean, every month a new plot, you know.
Yeah.
It would be absolutely mind breaking.
Yes.
I was about to say back breaking, but no, mind breaking.
And he was very aware, I'm sure, of his audience. I mean, he knew what Sherlock Holmes meant to people. I mean, you hear it said that he hated Sherlock Holmes. He didn't hate Sherlock Holmes. Of course, he didn't. He knew what he got, and he knew what he'd given his public.
Mm.
And he desperately didn't want to let them down. Okay, he thought it was light. He thought it was inconsequential. Fine. But he wanted it to be good.
Mm-hmm.
Desperately wanted it to be good.
And to people to read his histories.
Yes.
Which no one did.
Which,
Well, have you, read his histories?
I've read them. I have one of them, which I now don't remember which it is. It's one of the Boer War ones.
I've read Professor Challenger.
Professor Challenger, he would have put on a par with Holmes.
Yeah.
Professor Challenger was popular stuff.
Yeah,
they didn't count as his...
It's the White Company.
I mean, obviously, that's the White Company.
The White Company. The White Company. And I remember I opened it and I was like, oh, we'll get to this later.
Well, I always say that, you know, there are people who read the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, and then there are people who read the Sherlock Holmes mysteries and accidentally never stop reading the Sherlock Holmes mysteries. And I'm of the latter variety. But you read them the first time. When you read them the first time, I was like 10 years old too, and you really do want to know what the solution to the mystery is.
Absolutely.
You want to know what the why are all these redheaded men in this club? You want to know these things, but when you reread them and you read them over and over again, it's about the love and it's about this you know, brothers in arms, beautiful relationship between two people who were perfectly suited for each other.
Doyle was proud of his plots. Do you know the story about how he bet his wife that she couldn't work out who the murderer was in Silver Blaze?
No, I don't know the story.
Well, I mean, it slightly diminishes the story when you know that he bet her a shilling. But nonetheless, it was a bet. You will not work out the murderer.
Oh,
and,
Arthur.
I believe she either didn't or she pretended she didn't. I don't know.
She probably humored him. She knew all along.
I had no idea. I'm pretty sure when I read that one. That's a clever one.
Yeah,
so
it
is. Place
is
good.
It is.
Yeah.
Do you have any favorite memories from, like, the recording room?
So many. So many. I remember the very first day on the very first episode. Where no one was sure if it was going to work, you know, and that was wonderful. As soon as we knew it was going to work, I mean, that was wonderful.
Oh.
I remember The Solitary Cyclist, which, if you've not heard it, is a very musical episode.
Yeah.
It's got songs in it interspersed through, and they're sometimes sung in the scenes, and sometimes they're in between the scenes as comments on the action. And we were so lucky. We got a wonderful actor called Dennis Quilley, who I don't know how well known he was internationally, but in England, very famous. He created the part of Sweeney Todd in the Spielberg.
Oh, wow.
In the... Not Spielberg, surely.
Sondheim,
thank you.
Sondheim.
A Spielberg Sweeney Todd would be fascinating. he created that part in England, and he was tremendously good. And we were so lucky to get him. And so I remember that very fondly. I remember... in The Hound of the Baskervilles, when the producer told the cast after the read-through that our regular Mrs. Hudson couldn't make the recording. And everyone was terribly sad. And she said, but luckily I found a young actress, an up-and-coming actress who can do the part. And she won't be here just yet, so we'll just carry on. And just before we came to the Mrs. Hudson scene, Judy Dench went to the studio.
Oh, for the love of God.
And there's a photo of Michael and Judy sort of looking at each other.
Oh, that's
but and that was fun. And I remember the two last episodes, because after we did the complete canon, they very kindly commissioned me to write four series of new stories.
Oh.
And so actually, yes, the one I remember most is the very ending of the very final New Adventures, which was deliberately written. So we knew there weren't going to be any more. We knew the BBC didn't want any more.
Do you mean the end of the 60 by Doyle or the Adrian?
The end. We wrote the end of the retired colour man. It was
the retired colour man's the last one.
And I did that. The producer said to me, phoned me up, and she said, "Look, we want you to make this a real final ending because at that time we didn't know it anymore." She said, "Give it a sense of closure. Bring in the rest of the family. You know, get Mycroft in there. Get Lestrade in there." and I said, "How on earth am I supposed to do that?" And she, quite rightly, said, "Oh, I don't know. You're the writer."
That entire story hinges on paint.
but I did it. I mean, I looked at it. There are always clues in the stories for a dramatiser. Always clues. And I thought, well, Holmes, it's near the end of Holmes's active career. Let's make it the final case before he retires to the country. And Lestrade is about the same age as Holmes, probably. Let's make it Lestrade is retiring as well. So they have a nice little chat. Well, I hope it's a nice little chat in Lestrade's office, where they chat about old times and about how Lestrade loves the stories, even though he looks so bad in them. And Holmes, you mustn't blame me for that. So that sort of brought the curtain down quite nicely. And then we went on to do, as I say, the further adventures. And there were four series of those. And again, I knew by the end that the BBC wanted to cancel it. They didn't want any more. They thought, quite rightly, I think, they thought it had run its course. I was finding it harder and harder to come up with plots.
Yeah.
So the final episode was a two-parter. And they were all based on the throwaway references in the stories. So the final one,
Sumatra Company.
I deliberately didn't do the giant rat of Sumatra because, I mean, how could you possibly write a story that lives up to that title?
That's true.
But I did do, as the very final one, The Politician, The Lighthouse and The Trained Corvette.
Oh, that is so tantalizing.
Yeah. And it's a double episode. It's feature length. And the end of that was deliberately written as the grand finale. And I don't really want to tell you about it. I mean, if you can get hold of it and listen to it, please do. But it's Holmes and Watson in the sitting room, chatting about the case. Always my favourite scenes, those anyway. Mm-hmm. Chatting about the case, and they're talking about... Watson says, "Wouldn't it be wonderful if it could always be like this?"
Aww.
And Holmes says, "Well, but it can." And Watson says, "No, it can't. Nothing lasts forever." And Holmes says, "Yes, it can. Because of you. Aww. Because of your stories. You, my friend, have made us immortal."
That's beautiful.
And
we're melting again.
There's a melting happening.
I tell you, there were tears in the studio when we recorded that.
There's puddles everywhere in Bird's hotel room.
So having said that I wouldn't tell you about it, I've now told you about it. but go and buy the CDs anyway.
Yes, do.
Now, you wrote a book about this whole process. Can you tell us a bit about it for those who haven't picked it up and get it at wussexpress.com?
The book is called 221 BBC, which sometimes I think is a good title and sometimes I think is terrible. And it started off as a very, I suppose you could call it, a monograph. There was a Sherlock Holmes society in England called the Northern Musgraves, and they published a series of monographs, just slim little volumes, and they asked me if I was interested in doing one, so I wrote this. And a long time later, Gasogene Press, Stephen Doyle and Mark Gagin, were interested in republishing it. And I said, "Well, look, I mean, it's out of date now. Let me bring it up to date, at least." And they said, "Fine." And in bringing it up to date, it kind of grew a little. and it went from being sort of 40 pages to 260 pages. And it's available now from Gasogene Press. Buy your copy at once. And it's kind of like we've been chatting about. I mean, it's behind the scenes. It's got lots of script extracts in it. Yeah. It's got things about the process of dramatisation. It's got lots of pictures.
Yes.
And we're big fans of Wessex, so.
Yes. You're big fans of us. It's a mutually beneficial.
It's mutual.
Mutual, I'm sure.
But I love the fact that Judy Dench was like one, because she's constantly, frequently fan cast as Miss Hudson.
Yeah.
So many people just say, like, she needs to be...
I only wish it were a longer scene. I mean, it's a tiny little scene.
Yeah, well, that's a good, like, fact to know.
Well, as I recall it, Watson, she's angry at Holmes for something or other. And Watson tries to calm...
Exactly.
Watson good. Tries to calm her down by telling her they're having a distinguished visitor. He says, "No, Sir Henry Baskerville is coming tomorrow."
Uh-huh.
And she says, is he on his own? She said, no, Dr. Mortimer will be coming with him. And she said, oh, I suppose that means I've got to have that dog in my scullery again. And it was nice.
Great.
One nice thing about the series is that we had 45 minutes for every episode. Previously, they'd always been done at 30 minutes or 25 minutes.
There
on
is
radio.
A world
and
of difference.
The extra time just gave us a chance to spread a little, to look outside the story, to have little moments like that, to think of what the reality of it would have been like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dog would have had to go somewhere. I mean, yes. That food would have to be found at all sorts of weird hours and all the rest of it. And that was pleasant to be able to do that.
Which is the case where she wants to know when Sherlock Holmes wants dinner, and he says something like 6:45 the day after tomorrow.
I know, that's a lovely line. I don't know which story it was, but I do know that that wasn't one of the ones I did. I should say that after the first series that had three writers, I remained as head writer, but we had a little team of writers who kept changing series by series. And that was wonderful, because that brought in different attitudes and different approaches. Mm-hmm. But again, it meant that the script editing that wasn't really script editing had to be even more intensive as time went on.
The secret script editing?
No, not really. I mean, it's all in the past now anyway. But it's difficult. I mean, no two writers, in the same way that no two readers read the same story and see it the same, no two writers think of dramatising a story and see it the same way.
Exactly.
Yeah. A dramatisation is an interpretation. You know, if you're listening to My Hound of the Baskervilles, what you're listening to is my idea of what The Hound of the Baskervilles is all about, which is certainly not going to be the same as someone else's idea
yes.
of what The Hound of the Baskervilles is all about.
But that's the beauty about the home stories and the many adaptations that exist.
Yeah,
because there will always be new things and
yeah.
new ideas
yeah.
and interpretations.
Yeah. I think there's even another layer with radio, is that so they're hearing your interpretation, but they're hearing it so they can still visualize even further on their own interpretation.
It's closer to reading than it
yes.
is to watching film.
Yeah.
Yes.
The cliche is that the scenery is always better on the radio.
Oh,
yeah.
That's true, because it's
yeah.
in your mind.
Yeah. And we should say something about the technical teams as well on
oh,
the
yes.
shows, because the technical teams were wonderful.
Oh, good.
I mean, it's standard for BBC radio drama that enormous effort is put into the technical side, and what people often don't appreciate is that it's done very quickly and under great pressure for the technical people, and that they were doing other shows in between the Sherlock Holmes shows, so they had to think themselves into entirely different sort of worlds
yeah.
and come back to us again. And a lot of it was done in quite old studios with quite elderly equipment, and we always seem to manage to want to record at a time when work was going on in Broadcasting House, so you'd get into a scene and then you'd hear a pneumatic drill or something.
Oh.
We had to send runners out to find the workmen and bribe them to stop for a bit.
Oh.
But despite that, on as I say, what really was a shoestring budget compared to almost any other medium, they did wonders. And I think when it really works, and it does really work sometimes, the soundscape on those shows is so evocative. And it's often done with the simplest of means. But, you know, it lives, I think. It puts you there in the picture.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I just want to keep geeking out about radio, but I'll stop.
So you're fine.
I'm just like, because like when you're doing like soundscapes and creating work, like Foley work and like...
Foley work, yeah.
Did you do mostly Foley work, or did you do stuff like on location?
We never ever went on location. We wanted to do The Hound of the Baskervilles on location in a big
sure.
old country
yeah.
house, which would have been wonderful. But which brings its own problems.
Yeah, planes.
And also, it meant it would have sounded different
yes.
to the other shows
yeah.
in the series. So it was probably, in the end, the right decision not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
No, the policy is that when you record a scene in the studio, you try to get as many of the final elements mm-hmm. of the scene in at the time of the take. So if there are... Sound effects fall into two categories. There are background effects, which come from, in the early days, records or tapes, later days, CDs, the very later days, computers and computer banks, which are handled by a guy in the recording cubicle, who's also responsible for recording the show and all the rest of it. And there's a senior, studio manager is the BBC term, which is a very strange term, who sits at the desk and does the balance and the mix and all the rest of it. And you have a guy, it's never called Foley in radio, it's called spot effects.
Mm.
And it's called spot effects presumably because they're done on the spot.
Mm.
But it's a very, very difficult job. You have a guy, or more often actually a woman, in the studio with the actors, who acts as floor manager and sort of shepherds them around, as you hear there, you hear. But also does all the sound effects that they can't do because they're holding scripts.
Yes.
I mean, actors have a difficult enough time just turning the pages of a script without making a noise.
Yeah, we're really dumb.
Yeah. There's this will mean absolutely nothing without pictures, but there's a wonderful technique that the older and more experienced actors do of delivering a line, keeping looking at the microphone so their voices don't fade, moving the script away, turning the page, capturing the loose page, coming back again in time to do the next line. And it's lovely to watch. But the spot effects operator, it's very difficult because he has to act, or she has to act. And she has to be as good an actor as the actors are, because a lot of spot effects are timed to what the actor is doing.
Mm.
And a bad spot effect operator can ruin a performance.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Equally, a bad actor could ruin a good spot effects operator's performance. And it does happen both ways. But it's wonderful to see, because they have to be silent, obviously. And they have to weave in and out, and they have to get props and put props down and find new props. And it's lovely to watch. It's like a ballet. It's like a sort of silent ballet, weaving in and out of the action.
Opening doors, doing like boxes.
Oh, sure. And
hitting a cabbage with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
What does happen sometimes is that an actor will say, no, I want to do that.
Mm.
And that's usually bad news. Because, I mean, the actors, Clive was very, very fond. We had the Clive Merrison Memorial Music Stand, which had to be produced ceremoniously, so he could put his pages on there and do spot effects. Now, Clive is actually very good at spot effects, but there are a lot of actors who are not. And it can be very difficult, because they think you're attacking their core performance if you tell them they can't rattle a teacup properly, or they can't pour wine into a glass. Well, of course they can, but they can't. And they can't hear it divorced from their own, what they're doing. So it's tricky, that.
Part of the fun, I imagine.
Yeah, it's a whole different experience of creating.
Yes. Most of the BBC drama studios have blinds or curtains across the main big windows, and most producers don't watch what's going on, because it's very easy to see something happening and to fool yourself into thinking that it's understandable in terms of sound. Most producers, a lot of writers, will sit in the studio with their eyes closed, and if they can't hear what's happening, then they know it has to be redone.
That's very clever.
It puts you immediately where your audience will be hearing.
Absolutely.
For my master's, I had to do a 15-minute drama at the end, and I had to do that because they were like doing things. I'm like, I can't watch you anymore because it sounds wrong. It's like you're rattling chains, but it's not sounding what I want it to be. So, but no, that does work. Yeah. I actually think I just turned my chair around.
Yeah.
But then they couldn't get my attention because I wasn't looking at them.
The other reason not to watch is that quite often, what produces the right sound is not the right thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And that can be very off-putting. I mean, if I was once on a show when I worked at the BBC, when I was a sound effects operator for a time, and the producer wanted the sound of strawberries in crushed ice in a wicker basket wrapped in silk. And
okay,
I've forgotten now how I did it, but I did it somehow. And we did two takes, and it was lovely. It sounded great. And then the producer said, "Bert, what are you using for the strawberries?" And I thought, "Oh God!" Because as soon as he saw what I was doing, he wouldn't like it.
Yeah.
And I knew that absolutely. And we had a bit of a kerfuffle about that. But
what were you using?
I don't remember. I know it wasn't strawberry.
He's like gummy bears.
And I know it wasn't crushed ice, because, you know, crushed ice just disappears instantly.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a wicker basket, and it certainly wasn't silk. But it all sounded right. That was the point.
It's so funny. Sometimes we'll ask our followers, like, do you have any questions? And then sometimes we're like, oh, yeah, we should have checked that.
This was a really good question.
This was a good question.
Really helpful. See, my phone works fast enough.
You'll get, ask him why the hell they bothered, because the shows are dreadful.
No, people love them. There's a huge fan following for your radio
ad. Especially on Tumblr. There's like a huge Marison Radio, like just fandom community. It's so great.
And it's wonderful. And I really think that the reason for that people are so passionate about them is because it is obvious that what you were passionate about was the friendship and the relationships between all the people. They're humans, you know? And it's not that the mysteries aren't interesting or exciting or wonderful. Phosphorus smeared slavering hellhounds. I mean, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, the relationship between Holmes and Watson and Lestrade is wonderful. The relationship between, you know, like, just look at Six Napoleons.
Yeah.
The relationship between Holmes and Watson and Mrs. Hudson is wonderful. And Mycroft and all of these side
yeah.
characters.
Yeah.
So you really humanized it for
we wanted it to be real. Mm. That was the bottom line on it, right from the beginning. It's possible to do Victorian drama in a way that isn't real. You know, I mean, not send it up, but just very slightly heighten it, very slightly make it unrealistic. And we were adamant all the way through. I mean, one or two performances were roundly squashed by producers. No, real, make it real.
I think it's important very important for adaptations of Doyle for that, but you see it in Dickens too, because... Because Dickens writes such human stories,
yes, you know,
and they're marvelous, and they're full of such eccentric people. And
but it's so easy to go over the top with Dickens.
Really,
it is. Oh my God, it is.
Yeah.
And it's ridiculous. It's, it takes it out of all reality, and you need reality.
Yeah. So we do have three questions, but you've answered them all.
Oh, right.
It's like, was there ever talk of new stories adapted? You did do new stories.
I did.
And then Kenneth Smith, he asked if other British sleuths had ever been considered to take over after the original canon was completed.
Well, not after the original canon was completed, but after we finished the final adventure, I pitched Father Brown.
I love those.
And we did a pilot, and it was very well received, and the BBC didn't want it. They decided not to take it up.
Oh my God, they were wrong. G.K.
Chesterton
is perfect.
They might do it again with Chesterton. Like, there might be some year that...
It would be nice. But I mean, now they're on TV. Do you have them over here, the BBC TV ones, with Mark Williams?
We can access most British stuff eventually, because it tends to end up on PBS.
Yeah. They're nice. I mean, they've had to do things to it.
Yeah.
I mean, they've put him into one place, which, of course, he's not in the story. He roams about the place. And they've given him a little sort of fixed entourage.
Yeah.
But, it works nicely. And they're beautiful.
Chesterton's writing is beautiful.
Mm.
That's gorgeous prose.
The Father Brown stories.
Me too. Yeah.
And some of it's quite gory. Some of it's quite
it's lurid stuff. Yeah.
I mean, the one we did as the pilot is the one where the body is found beheaded in the sealed garden.
Yeah.
And that's gorgeous stuff.
No, it's ripping.
I mean, Chesterton was like, he liked... to be a bit more, out there.
Yeah, I mean, in the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, you really very often don't even have a crime at all, per se. You just have a very eccentric circumstance. And then, you know, the goriest and most lurid I think he probably gets is a cardboard box. But even he didn't really care for writing cardboard box.
Yeah.
I think he was just a gentleman of certain refined sensibilities. But Chesterton gets his hands dirty.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that question was from Kenneth on Facebook.
Great.
Thanks, Ken. Unless you don't like being called Ken. Thanks, Kenneth. Okay. Is there any other stories or things running around your head that you want to share with the world that you haven't divulged in your book or...
Oh, that's difficult, isn't it?
It's preferably something you didn't tell. I hear of Sherlock everywhere.
Well, that's tricky as well. That was a long interview. Did I tell them about the stage play? I've written a stage play, a Sherlock Holmes stage play.
Sure.
I think I maybe did. We talked about The Lion's Mane, how it's a two-hander. And one of the further adventures is also a two-hander. But it's a two-hander with a walk-on. And I wrote a stage play with the two of them. The Lion's Mane is the first one. I beg your pardon, the other one is the first one. The Abbot of Any Murder.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where they're in London. And then The Lion's Mane after he's retired. So that's a stage play. If anyone out there wants to put on a stage play... If anyone out there is a millionaire or a TV producer, please get in touch, because I do have a pilot and a complete Bible for a TV series. Victorian set... with Holmes and Watson at the beginning of their careers, never been done in quite the same way. Please get in touch.
Aww. Oh, marvellous.
Yes, please. Great. And where can people find your stuff? Or do you have a website where they can look
it up? If you put my name into Google, it will take you straight to my website.
Great.
And if you put BBC Holmes into Google, once you've gone all through Benedict Cumberbatch, you come to the site merisonholmes.com, which is all about the radio shows. And there's a link to that from my site as well. So,
wonderful.
And that's got details of how to order the shows, and it's got full cast lists and behind-the-scenes pictures and all kinds of stuff.
I wonder if, I imagine also if you were to Google Sherlock Holmes Clive Merrison, you'd probably...
Oh, absolutely. It'll take you straight there. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Wunderbar. So go do that now, if you're listening to it now. And definitely listen to them, because they're fantastic. I think the first one I listened to was Scandal. I think I was trying to do it in order. And it was just so wonderful. I was like, this is what I want in my ears all the time.
Thank you. They do crop up quite regularly on a BBC digital station called Radio 4 Extra.
Yeah.
Which I think is available all across the world.
You can stream it.
Yes, it's not restricted to the UK. So look out for them there.
They do pop up quite often, actually.
They had a scheme to broadcast the entire canon in chronological order, not in publication.
Oh, cool.
And
so you started with Study in Scarlet.
We would have done. It never happened.
Yeah, gotcha. And then would it end with his last bow, then?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool.
It would have been a lovely idea, but all sorts of difficulties. Like, I mean, you'd had to intersperse the novel-length ones with the short story ones.
How about difficulties like dating the canon?
Well, exactly, yes. I mean,
Holmes is actually not in town at the moment, but he's still solving murders.
And he's solving murders in 1893. You're like, he's dead.
Yeah. You have the Moriarty thing where Watson's heard of him in one story and not in another. All kinds of stuff. So we were able to screw it over doing it in publication order.
Yeah.
We didn't care about things like that. I mean, the concept was, if mistakes and anachronisms and all the rest of it are good enough for Conan Doyle, they're certainly good enough for us.
I get screwed up with this, though, because the Chronicles of Narnia, which I loved when I was a kid...
That's an even more complicated chronology.
Well, it's a very complicated chronology, but it goes... Like, the publication order is the way I read it as a child, and then they re-released them, starting with...
Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Well, no, that was the publication order. Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was the first
one.
The Magician's Nephew, they reordered them to start with The Magician's Nephew, and
earlier.
Because it's considerably earlier, and I was thrown. like these box sets of the chronological C.S. Lewis books, I was like, no, that's not it. I was a purist when it came to that.
Yeah. I mean, I think if it had happened, it would have been fun, but I would have just made up a chronology.
That would have been
pinched one of the existing ones, I don't know. But I think it would have confused people. That's a point worth making. One of the things we had to very strongly bear in mind is that most of the people who heard our shows didn't know a thing about Sherlock Holmes. They might have heard the name. Mm. They might have known he was a detective. They might have known that Watson was around. But that was probably as far as it went. And there's a terrible danger of playing to the fans, which we desperately tried to avoid. We didn't always succeed, and I chucked a few jokes in here and there. But we were very aware that people didn't know the stories. Mm. I had someone once talk to me about, Sherlock Holmes, there's something about a dog. it's only the most famous story, but it's a perfectly legitimate question. If you don't know...
Yeah.
Then you have to be told.
That's true.
And the goal ultimately that you achieved and that the right kinds of adaptations achieve is to create new fans.
Absolutely.
Not to necessarily be pandering to people who already love it. I mean, I'll watch The Asylum Sherlock Holmes, but I've already seen it 50 times.
Some of the most heartening letters and emails we received were from people who said, You put me to the stories. You took me to the stories.
That's
the best.
The great stories thing. Are what it's about.
Yeah.
I think that's a lovely note to end on, actually.
Yes.
Okay.
Also to give you time to get ready.
Because we're about to go to the BSI dinner.
Can I say thank you very much? It's been a lovely experience.
Well, thank you.
Thank you
so much. Right. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, because when I heard that you were coming, I'm like, we have to get on an interview.
Thank you.
Because I wanted to ask you... from Gillette to Brett, but I was too nervous. Because we were sitting next to each other, and I was like, who's sitting next to me? I don't know if I was texting you or if I was just tweeting, being like, I want Brett Coles to be my best friend. He doesn't know yet.
Even after we had that fun distributing the stolen cake. There was a kind of reception thing, and there was loads of cake, and most of it didn't get eaten. And then there was another thing somewhere else, and Christina and I sort of we grabbed a cake and we took it down. We desperately tried to get people to eat this cake, which meant walking up to people and saying, "Have some cake." What?
There's really nothing sadder than wasted cake.
I know. Yeah.
I was like, because I couldn't eat it. And there was just too much cake for like how few of us that were there. Because it was just like the speakers that were given this giant cake. And we're like, oh, what are we going to do with the cake? So we stole the cake.
All right, we are at the BSI dinner in the reception room. It's really loud, but Tim has a question that we missed. So, Tim, what is your question?
My question for Bert Pools is, will he consider, please, re-teaming with Clive Merrison for an audio version of Mr. Holmes, especially now that he's here this weekend, and so is Jeffrey Hatcher. Can we get the two of them together to talk about this project for Radio 4? Bert, what do you say?
My answer is, it's a wonderful idea, and I would love to do it, but unfortunately, these things are not up to the writer. It would need to be the BBC you would have to convince of the need for a Mr. Holmes on radio.
But doesn't it sound like a license to print money, Bert?
Only amongst Sherlockians, unfortunately.
And there is a very honest answer from Bert Pools. I would kind of actually really love to see that, I'm not going to lie. And then I'd be really sad also to listen to that.
It would be very sad.
I'd be sad. Thank you, Jimmy Digger.
Thank you, Bert.
Thank you, Bert Pools.
I'll tell you one thing. If I did do it for radio, the boy would not.
If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?